I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show.
Hi, this is Howard Jacobson, and I am thrilled to be talking via Skype today with my friend, Dr. Emerson Wickwire. Hello, Emerson.
Hello, Howie.
So you actually provided me with an introduction, so I can actually like not kind of make things up and flub them. So I'll give this to folks as a teaser for what we're going to be talking about, which is sleep and the relationship between getting enough and enough quality sleep and a lot of other things that we care about, like our energy levels, our fitness, our weight, the foods we eat, the cravings we have or don't have. So that's where we're going. So let me now explain a little bit about why you're the man. So Dr. Emerson Wickwire is the Sleep Medicine Program Director at Pulmonary Disease and Critical Care Associates in Columbia, Maryland, and Assistant Professor part-time at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, where he completed a 2-year postdoc fellowship in sleep. Dr. Wickwire is board certified in behavioral sleep medicine and cognitive and behavioral psychology, and we're going to get into what all that is quite soon. And he's a recognized expert in the non-drug treatment of sleep disorders and comprehensive approaches to managing chronic disease, with a particular interest in leveraging technology to improve patient care. And those of you who've been listening to my podcast for a while know that I'm kind of a fanboy of lots of technologies that that can give us insights and are just fun to play with and are holistic ways in rather than just giving us reductionist data points. Dr. Wickwire has published over 24 peer-reviewed scientific articles, book chapters, and scientific abstracts, and has served as a reviewer for numerous academic publications, and he is also the author of several sleep-related informational products, which I think we are going to be talking about on a later call as they develop and go to market, and I'm hoping I get to be a guinea pig for those. And when he is not sleeping himself, Dr. Wickwire remains an active and award-winning medical educator. He's on the education committees for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the National Sleep Foundation, and the American Pain Society. He's lectured at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, University of Maryland, Walter Reed Army Medical Center, National Intrepid Center of Excellence at Bethesda Naval Medical Center, and elsewhere. So this is no slacker we have on the Skype with us today. Welcome, Dr. Emerson Wickwire.
Thank you very much.
So the first question I have for you is, why is sleep important? Like, let me start with just, you know, the idiot question. Like, why should I care about the quality or quantity of my sleep?
Well, depending on who you are and how old you are, there are going to be several different reasons why you should care about sleep. But the bottom line is that throughout the lifespan, even prenatally, sleep is one of the most reliable and robust predictors of health, broadly defined. Howard, I know that you have a obviously a particular interest in diet and daytime performance. One way to think about it is that the average American adult will spend over the course of his or her lifetime 24.8 years of his or her life asleep. It puts the importance of the bed and bedroom and having a comfortable mattress and so forth in a little bit different light. And if this weren't important, if sleep didn't serve a vital function from an evolutionary perspective, then it's an absolutely huge mistake.
meaning when we're asleep, we can't run away from animals, we can't chase food, we can't rear our young, we can't, we're obviously giving up an awful lot in order to do this sleep thing.
Exactly right, to do this sleep thing.
Okay. So when I always assumed that like sleep was just, kind of recharging my batteries. Is that a useful way to think of it, or are there more nuanced, kind of models?
Well, both. It is a useful way to think of it. And in a brushstroke sort of way, that's what sleep is. It's a slowing down. During sleep, we consume less oxygen. Our heart rate slows down. Our respiration rate slows down. The electrical activity in our brains slow down. Our blood pressure decreases. So it is a slowing down period. But it's also a very active, structured period. In preparation for the call, Howard, you and I had spoken some about circadian rhythms, which are broad, roughly 24.2-hour biorhythms, which are more of a macro rhythm. And then there are also micro rhythms within the course of a day called an ultradian rhythm. This lasts about 100 minutes, give or take. And these rhythms or cycling functions take place not only while we're awake, but also throughout the night while we're asleep. So sleep doesn't happen like a light switch. And what I mean by that is that you don't just sort of fall asleep and stay flatline for 8 hours and then wake up later. Actually, during the course of the night, you're waxing and waning in and out of deeper stages of sleep, including having a number of awakenings, 6 to 12 awakenings. It's just that they're so brief that most of the time you don't recall them. So it is a slowing down period, but it's also a very structured period with specific physiologic and other functions.
So this, what are some of the other functions? I remember reading a few years ago, I think it was John Medina's book, Brain Rules, where he was talking about learning. What's the relationship between sleep quality and different types of learning?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know the book. So there are different stages of sleep is one of the most important things to understand. And if you think about sleep as it's most commonly defined, which has to do with EEG frequency, what that means, Howard, is that sleep is objectively defined. So in order to quantify sleep or define sleep or measure sleep, you actually have to be measuring using what's called an EEG or electroencephalograph. That's where they stick all those wires on your skull, using paste they have to comb out of your hair and things. That's how sleep is measured. And so you end up seeing a whole bunch of squiggly lines, and the height of those lines and the space between those lines, by that I mean the amplitude and the frequency of those lines, that's how sleep is defined. So different stages of sleep, including wakefulness, are associated with different frequencies of EEG activity. So there used to be essentially five stages of sleep, and then a scientific consensus came out in 2007 and reduced it to now there are only four stages of sleep. Those stages are what are called rapid eye movement sleep, which you've heard about, and that's when most dreaming takes place. And then there are three stages of what we would call non-rapid eye movement sleep, which are non-REM 1, 2, and 3. And those stages represent increasingly slow frequencies of sleep. So in other words, stage N1 is closer to wakefulness. Stage N3 is farther away from wakefulness. During stage N3, your brain is, this is what we call deep sleep or delta sleep. It's when your brain waves are oscillating very, very slowly. Now, so when we talk about different functions that take place during sleep, we really want to think, well, okay, what's happening in these different stages? And the answers remain somewhat plastic, even though we have some pretty good clues. For example, stage N3 sleep, the deepest stage of sleep, most of which tends to take place in the first third of the night, is associated with the secretion in a pulsative fashion of human growth hormone. So this is what leads us to feel physically restored and refreshed and regenerated and robust. This is when hair follicles regenerate and so on and so forth. It also decreases over the course of the lifespan. So although we can't conclusively demonstrate a causal relationship, we can absolutely demonstrate a correlational relationship between decreases in stage N3 sleep and the aging process, for example. Conversely, if we look at learning, at cognitive function and so on and so forth, this will take place often during stage N2 sleep. Emotional processing is often associated with stage REM sleep. So each stage of sleep has, we can make brushstroke generalizations about exactly what's happening during the brain, and experimentally we can also deprive healthy humans or animals of various stages of sleep and then watch essentially what they're not able to do as well. For example, Michael Jackson, as you know, was taking a very powerful surgical anesthetic, which essentially deprived him of REM sleep for 2 months. So functionally, he, even though he was taking this strong medication and sort of knocking himself out every night, he actually wasn't really getting any sleep at all. During his testimony, Chuck Zeisler, who's a very, very well-regarded sleep scientist at Harvard, essentially said, yeah, he'd been completely sleep-deprived for 2 months. He'd had absolutely no REM sleep, and that was the certainly a contributing cause to his death. So I'm going to let you narrow the focus here and redirect, but in a nutshell, each stage of sleep can be associated with specific physiologic functions, including not only learning and memory, but also physical restoration.
Wow. I'm processing very intensely now, because what I sort of have heard some of this stuff before, but the way you put it, it really reminds me of the way I'm approaching nutrition, which is, there's definitely different nutrients in food, and it's really useful to understand that, you know, fats do this and carbohydrates are good for this and proteins. And then we can get much more, granular and talk about what vitamin C does or phytochemicals and stuff like that. But there is a kind of a grand symphony. And it sounds like that, what we're learning, really interesting, fascinating things about sleep. And the reason we're learning them is that we have a kind of sleep nutrition deficiency, that people aren't getting the sleep nutrients that they need. And so we're seeing experimentally, and we're seeing kind of as a society, the effects of poor sleep. I guess I'm jumping ahead of maybe where this conversation is, so I'm thinking about kind of how to stitch it together, but do you see sleep as a bunch of stages or ultimately as kind of a very holistic experience that has these, nuanced elements to it?
Oh, I think that's a great question, and I don't think that we're too far ahead of the skis at all. I think one of the things that happens anytime we're learning a new sleep, in some ways, it's like it's like outer space or the ocean. It's this vast, experience that's just ripe for exploration. So when I speak with bright folks like yourself, it just takes an interesting tidbit or two about sleep before the gears get turning and hopefully folks begin to get interested and realize how important this is. Like I said, 25 years of your life. So I think that the answer is both. And absolutely, sleep is there are no hard and fast rules from a public health perspective. In other words, sometimes folks ask me about the results of their sleep study and what's the distribution of my sleep stages and how does this compare to the distribution of my sleep stages for a healthy adult my age. And these are all fair questions, but they also sort of miss the point. In other words, first we want to look at things holistically. And then if there are deficiencies, I think it becomes useful to start to look at things at a more granular level. So for the average for the average listener on the podcast, for example, you may have some curiosity about the distribution of sleep stages, but you want to think first about your overall subjective sleep quality and quantity and your daytime function and a much more holistic sort of overview of sleep. If there are problems that you begin to identify in your energy level, in your dietary cravings, in your mood or cognitive performance and so on and so forth, then it may be useful to begin to look at where that symphony may be breaking down. Because the bottom line is that the same way with maintaining a healthy, balanced diet, there's a lot of plasticity. I remember once when I was a trainee, and Hopkins is a superior place for a voracious learner to be a trainee, because you're just surrounded by some of the brightest folks in the world. And there was a conversation about stage N3, or what's called slow wave sleep, and REM sleep. And if you look at the published data and you tell me the age of a patient, we know that this patient should have about this much slow wave sleep and about this much REM sleep if you look at the sort of aggregate over the course of a night. But the fact is that those numbers are really plastic. And so someone might have more REM sleep and less slow wave sleep, and someone else might have it the opposite, and these two folks are going to function just fine. The same way, and I'll let you correct any mistakes I make from a nutritional perspective, but the reality is that there's also some plasticity. You don't need to maintain the same carbohydrate count 7 days a week, or the same ratio of carbohydrates to protein 7 days a week to maintain a healthy diet. Now, when things start to break down, then it might get the finer tooth comb, I think, can come in handy.
Right. Well, I'm really starting to see some connections here, and I'm so grateful to you for laying this out. So it's certainly true that we don't have to, like, fret obsessively about, you know, carbs to proteins to anything else, or how many grams of beta carotene we're taking in. But our bodies do that really well naturally. And we, you know, if we were in a natural environment, we would be within very, very close tolerances to our ideal pretty much all the time. Based on what our cravings were, what our bodies told us we wanted to eat. Do you want an apple? Do you want, an avocado? And the problem is that we're in a really unnatural environment, and so we can have all sorts of issues, and we don't even think to talk about nutrition as the cause of the issues because we're doing what everyone else is doing. So by the same token, I'm imagining that from your perspective, we live in a crazy messed up sleep culture.
It's a wonderfully apt metaphor, and I couldn't agree with you more. To use your cravings example, sleep is certainly a leading cause of what we might call, I'm trying to think of a more eloquent description, but screwed up cravings. when our appetite hormones are out of whack, we can crave the wrong kinds of foods. And if it would be useful, Howard, for your listeners, I'd be happy to explain a little bit more about what I mean.
Yeah, just, I want to kind of just frame it in my own mind that, you know, like I know lots of people who brag about how badly or how little they sleep. Like,
you know, right.
You know, so that there's something, you know, I before we get into sort of the effects of poor sleep habits or, and I'm guessing there's lots of poor habits that we do while we're awake that affect our sleep. But it just seems like we are a culture that the same way we've messed up our relationship with food, we've significantly messed up our relationship with sleep, and there's far less awareness about sleep hygiene than there is about nutrition hygiene, which is saying something.
Right, exactly, because there's a such a profound lack of awareness about nutrition hygiene. A lot of it started post-industrial revolution with Thomas Edison, who, as I'm sure you know, was invented the. He actually wasn't the first light bulb inventor, but he invented the light bulb that stuck, so to speak, in terms of having a long-lasting filament and so on and so forth. Along with, I think he had over 1,000 patents. Edison propagated this myth of sort of man as machine, and we can light things 24 hours a day. We can live in a lit world 24 hours a day, and man can always be working and so on and so forth. But what most folks don't know is that Edison actually had a nap cot in a side room off of his laboratory. And of course, when he would bring in journalists and so on and so forth to view the great true genius, Thomas Edison, and what was happening in his research and so on and so forth, no one ever saw the lab. They just saw the myth. Edison was also, one might use the word, addicted, but he was certainly, consumed large quantities of, a French red wine called Via Mariani, which is infused with cocoa. So, you know, even the source of the myths, if you take a little bit closer look, it just doesn't stand up. We need sleep. It's in the military. I do a great deal of work with the Department of Defense, and that's military sleep is. Something that's near and dear to my heart, because our warriors are suffering such significant sleep disturbances and the consequences of disturbed sleep. The military has invested a tremendous amount of research and development dollars. When you have people flying billion-dollar planes, you don't want them falling asleep. So it's just a basic biological need that that really can't be overcome. In fact, you could argue that the biological drive for sleep is stronger than the biological drive for hunger or thirst. You will sleep involuntarily. This should cause you some concern as you are on the highway, because folks on the road are sleeping involuntarily because of their own sleep loss, and a substantial percentage of motor vehicle crashes are associated with driver drowsiness and fatigue and so on and so forth.
So here's the point in the interview where I asked you the question that I'm going to later use for the bullet points to get people to listen out of personal interest and fear. So how do you know when you are, and I don't know if the right word is sleep deprived, but you know, if you're not getting enough sleep or, you know, a quantity or a quality, how can you tell? How would someone know that this, they should listen to the rest of this podcast, you know, or just, you know, for academic purposes, or whether this is something that's important for their health?
Sure. So, let's answer that in two ways. And I'm going to draw an arbitrary line that talks about, insufficient but otherwise healthy sleep, on the near side. And then on the far side, we might have what we'd think of as clinical sleep disorders. And we can talk about the first topic, and potentially the second topic today, but the sleep disorders, we'll just see where the conversation goes. We can address that today or in the future.
Okay.
One of the easiest markers for insufficient sleep, and I'm going to name three, but one of them is, do I feel tired during the day? Do I feel tired at any time during the day? Do I notice that it becomes more difficult to concentrate? Is my energy level just low? From speaking to a nutrition savvy audience, folks are very aware of the role that proper diet can have in my energy level and mood and so on and so forth. But I would argue that if you're not feeling energetic during the day, the first place to look is, well, what happens during this third of the day that should be serving a restorative function. So one is, what about my daytime performance? Am I experiencing irritability or stress or lack of concentration, memory complaints, lethargy or anhedonia? By that I mean symptoms of depressed mood. What's going on during the day? The second...
Hold on a second, because it sounds to my ears what you said was, you know, am I human? Like, I don't know anyone who doesn't complain about getting tired during the day, who doesn't have, you know, periods of low function. You know, you're saying that that's not normal?
Well, yeah, I am.
Yes, I mean, you know, defend yourself, man. I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm saying that, you know, it's not normal to fall off a cliff at a certain point during the day. And the fact that there's a problem here, you only have to go fill your car with gas and see, you know, two refrigerators full of energy drink variations and, you know, 5 hour energy, this or that. What we're doing is we're jacking ourselves up on stimulants during the day, and then we're taking some version of a hypnotic at night. Things are totally out of whack. That's exactly what I'm saying. And if you don't feel as well as you would like to during the day, I would encourage you to begin to ask some questions about the third of your life that should be serving a restorative function. The second indicator of poor sleep is how quickly you fall asleep when you hit the pillow. Oftentimes folks brag that they're out within 30 seconds, or I'm out within 2 minutes of putting my head on the pillow. Well, thanks, pal, for just letting me know how chronically sleep deprived you are. This is not a sign of healthy sleep. This is a sign of a lasting sleep debt. If you're falling asleep faster than 5 minutes, it means you're not getting enough sleep, or that you have a sleep disorder. Typically, we would look at what we call a sleep latency of anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes is kind of in the normal range.
So when you say falling asleep within 10 to 20 minutes, does that include like lying in bed reading, or after you've turned out the lights, closed your eyes with the intention of falling asleep? Should you be awake for 10 to 20 minutes at that point? Like when do we start the timer for that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And really I'm talking about, I'm not talking about the reading example. Reading in bed and doing, sort of non-sleep activities in bed is a bit of a side topic, a very important one if you're having trouble sleeping. But if you get in bed and read for a little while and find that relaxing and soothing and part of your sleep routine, and then you turn out the light and fall asleep easily, that's not a red flag. If you brush your teeth and wash your face, or if you are too sleepy to accomplish those tasks and you crawl into bed and find yourself out before your head hits the pillow, I'm going to be very interested why.
Okay. Great. So that we've gotten two, right? The tired during the day and fall asleep as soon as your head hits the pillow. So you said there was a third one?
Yeah, the third one I'm going to use just as a sort of teaser for the second broad topic, which would be disordered sleep. If you have trouble falling asleep, if you have trouble staying asleep, or if you snore or have been told that you snore, these are red flags. And unfortunately, partially, Howard, because the cartoons that you and I watched when we were kids, partially because of these, what I think are just horribly, at best misleading, commercials, I'll pick on, Johnson & Johnson product, that has a Tylenol PM ad out where they have someone snoring. Take Tylenol PM and then they have this guy snoring like you're going to get a good night's sleep. Snoring is not a sign of good sleep. So trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, or snoring are all warning signs that something's not working properly in your sleep system.
So is snoring a symptom or a cause or both? And I'm asking this. I don't snore at all, although everyone that I've ever shared a room with says I do. So I want to make it clear that that's completely false.
Yeah.
But, you know, so when you hear that, where does your mind go?
Well, we've got it on tape, so clearly that's the yeah.
Well, you know, people have also played back tapes, you know, in their desperation of what they claim to be my snoring.
It was someone else. It was their dog or yeah.
I don't know how they did it, because one of them was a video. It was incredibly well done, but I'm still in complete denial, as you can tell.
Complete. So snoring is absolutely a warning sign. Howie, for the edification of your listeners, would you imitate briefly the snoring that these folks manufactured?
All right, I could lay down and probably give it to you for real. So what my wife says is that the sort of rockabye baby snoring, the you know, is very soothing. But I will wake her up when I do, like a really loud, sharp, sudden snort.
Sure.
And so I go back and forth between sawing wood and explosions.
So first, thank you for that. Second, I want to assure your listeners that this is not scripted.
I think they know by now that nothing in my life is scripted. Except your intro.
Yeah, that's right. Let me make a couple comments. First, if you were at a workplace and someone in a cubicle next to you breathed the way that you just snored, I mean, if that was just their mode of breathing during the workday, how might you respond?
Man, that is a mind-altering question. With great concern, annoyance, judgment, fear.
Yeah, I'd be like, call 911. What's going on? This guy's about to keel over. But somehow we've been duped into thinking that snoring is a sign of good sleep, or that snoring is a normal during sleep, and it's simply not. During sleep, we breathe. And snoring is a sign of disordered breathing. So snoring, most important thing, is a warning sign, and we don't want to be doing it. We don't want to be doing it for a number of different reasons. Snoring is a neuropathy, and what that means is that it's progressive. So snoring is low-grade vibratory trauma in the upper airway, and the more that those tissues, that those neuromuscular soft tissues in the upper airway are vibrated and thrashed around and so on and so forth, the more collapsible they become. So, Howard, when you were a boy, did you ever take a blade of grass and put it between your thumbs, or even now? This yeah. morning, before we got on the call? Yeah. Sitting on your back porch? And then you blow, right, with that piece of grass between your thumbs and it vibrates.
Right.
Well, the reason that it vibrates is that you have a lot of air moving through a small space. So everything that's not nailed down shakes, and that vibration makes the whistling noise. And that's exactly what's happening during snoring. The tissues in the upper airway are collapsing. So your brain and vital organs still need the same quantity of oxygen. Your diaphragm is still pulling at roughly the same intensity, but there's not enough air. There's not enough space in the upper airway. So the same quantity of air is trying to come through a smaller space, in the same way that that blade of grass vibrated when you were a boy or this morning. The tissues in the upper airway are vibrating, right? So as these progressively collapse farther and farther, that means that there's even less space for the air to get through. And eventually what happens is that a guy like me, or a sleep disorder specialist, is able to recognize, using data gathered during a sleep study, what are called distinct breathing events. The most common of these, and you and I had touched base on this briefly, are called, or the most well-known of these, I should say, are called apneas. Apnea and sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, is the most common sleep-related breathing disorder. Apnea comes from the Greek. It means literally no breath or no air, because at this point, the tissues in the upper airway have completely collapsed. So literally, no breath or no air is able to make its way through. So if you think back to normal breathing, where I inhale and exhale and so on and so forth, and that oxygen is extracted and distributed via the bloodstream, in obstructive sleep apnea, of which snoring is the first step, or the most mild form of sleep-related breathing disorders, and apnea is the most severe form because it's complete closure, my brain is going to not get the oxygen that it needs. And oftentimes those oxygen levels will fall lower than can support human life. So my brain goes into panic mode. It sends signals to the diaphragm to breathe harder, to try and open this blockage. It sends signals to the tissues in the upper airway saying, hey guys, you know, pop open here, like we're suffocating. And what you end up with is a violent sounding snort, where the pressure has increased such that the kind of vacuum seal in the upper airway is broken. So that at least I can finally get some air. Now, I'll let you connect the dots.
Okay. Well, I'm less interested in the dots than in, like, calling an ambulance to get me to... Now I'm really motivated to do... I've never really been motivated to do anything about it before. It just was like, you know, this is what happens. This is what some people do.
Right.
It sounds awful. It sounds like, from, you know, back in my world, the equivalent of a cardiovascular blockage, you know, the way the endothelium will peel away and you can have a heart attack or a stroke. It sounds like, you know, this is more forgiving. There's a mechanism to kind of deal with it rapidly without killing me, but it sounds awful and it sounds serious. So I guess my questions are, like, one of my favorite songs is Tom Waits' "You're Innocent When You Dream," and I think, like, I'm innocent. I'm not doing anything wrong here. Like I'm almost feeling like you're describing my snoring it's like I'm blameworthy somehow, and I know this is like completely irrational, but it's where my mind is going, and I want to protest and say, but I'm asleep, I have no control over this. So where are we talking symptomatic, and where are there causes that I, you know, can do something about, because I've been snoring since, you know, since I was a little kid. And in fact, I used to, my first summer at summer camp when I was 12 years old, the counselor came in the first night and he thought there was like an animal in our bunk because I was making some, like a scratching noise at the back of my throat.
Yeah, of course. Well, so the real question that you're asking is what causes sleep apnea, and the subtext is, you know, what am I doing wrong? And you're not doing anything wrong. I'll talk about causes in just a sec, but most patients have exactly the same reaction that you did, which is, hey, wait a minute. I'm asleep, you know, what are you telling me? You're sort of protesting and with your friends and saying, I don't snore anyway. And, you know, they've got like the video crew and they're saying, are you so sure? It's very common. 90% of sleep-related breathing disorders remain undiagnosed. Folks don't know that they have it. And because there are stereotypes associated with having it, primarily for women, snoring is unladylike, so on and so forth. Women don't want to have snoring or sleep apnea, and men associate snoring or sleep apnea most commonly with being obese or overweight or out of shape or unrobust or some other unmanly attribute. So no one wants to have it. But like I said, it's very common. It's more common than asthma. And it has significant health-related consequences, from obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular risk, neurocognitive dysfunction, sexual complaints. I could go on and on. But the second part, so the first answer, Howie, is it's not your fault. And if you have had a lifelong history of snoring, then it's even more suggestive that it's not your fault, because one of the causes of snoring or sleep apnea has to do with the shape of the upper airway. And you, unless you are photoshopping 120 pounds off of yourself since last time I've seen you in person, are not overweight or obese. So it has to do with the shape of the upper airway. It also has to do with the patency of the tissues in the upper airway, or just the collapsibility of those tissues. The same way that some people naturally have more taut or robust biceps, some people naturally have more taut or patent musculature in the upper airway. Let me go back to what I said earlier about snoring being progressive and this sort of localized trauma. There was actually recently in Sleep, which is the sort of flagship academic sleep research journal, in the past year, there was a very interesting study that actually caused sleep apnea in patients by inducing snoring, and then the tissues would the tissues in the upper airway would become less collapsible following this experimentally induced vibration. So you're not doing anything wrong, but there are highly effective treatments for obstructive sleep apnea, which I know folks want to ask about and hear about, but it would be you need to start with assessment and diagnosis before you can talk about treatment options. And before you know that you have sleep apnea, even when you're describing witnessed apneas, which are a highly reliable indicator of obstructive sleep apnea, because if your wife is seeing those during the limited time that she's awake while you're asleep, almost invariably you're experiencing those more at times when she is also asleep, therefore unable to see them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. the first thing that you need to do is have a test and find out if you have it. And there are a number of ways, and we can talk about that now or offline as you prefer, to have that tested. It is a medical test at this time, and I would encourage you and all of your listeners to avoid any infomercial self-diagnosis kind of gizmos. This is, it's easily treatable, but it's also not something you want to screw around with. If you suspect, you or any of your listeners suspect that you have a sleep-related breathing disorder, talk to your doctor. I'm going to go anti, self sort of medication on this one.
Okay. Fair enough. So I know that there's a near me in North Carolina, there's the Duke Sleep Disorders Clinic. So that I would, call them up and say, I snore and I've been told that I snort, and can you paste some things to my head and let me sleep?
Yeah, exactly. That's what's called an in-lab sleep study. I know the facility at Duke, and offline I'm happy to connect you with someone there. There are also what are called at-home sleep tests, which have become increasingly popular in the past several years, but that is a rapidly rising tide. The insurance companies like it because they are far, far less expensive to diagnose patients at their home than having patients go someplace like Duke. And many patients like it because they're intimidated, mostly because they don't really understand what happens, but they're intimidated about going to the sleep lab. And that's understandable. They want to sleep in their own bed. So Howard, as someone with a doctorate and a master's degree in public health and so on and so forth, from a public health perspective, home sleep testing will allow far more people in a cost-effective way to be diagnosed and treated. But there are trade-offs. It's more efficient but less robust, the data that is gathered. So, for example, if you have a home sleep test because your doctor suspected that you have obstructive sleep apnea, but that test turns out negative, the next step would be to go to the in-lab sleep study. In other words, it's not as fine tooth a comb. So, you'd still have to follow up with the in-lab test because we originally suspected that you had it in the beginning, and the home sleep test can only say yes, it can't say no.
So there's much more risk of false negatives than false positives with the home sleep test.
There's virtually no risk of false positive with a home sleep test. That's exactly right.
Okay. So you recommend that people like not go shopping on Amazon for this. You do it through a doctor.
Yeah, there was a patient brought me a printout. The answer is yes, absolutely do it through a doctor. A patient brought me some European advertisement a year or so ago saying you can diagnose your own sleep apnea. And it was a consumer product. And someday the science may be there. In our country, these things are regulated appropriately and thankfully by the FDA and you know, you want to be wary of anyone who tells you that they can treat your medical condition who doesn't even really have an accurate assessment or diagnosis of your medical condition. I definitely would say play it. You used the example earlier of an infarction or a cerebrovascular event. I can't recall what you mentioned. Yeah, if it's a heart attack or a stroke, you're not going to buy a gizmo on Amazon. Use the same approach here.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, it sounds like I should talk to you offline about my own particular condition. It seems like it's common, but it's not universal, and it's not inclusive of everyone. But so let's say that the test reveals something, and so what are some like non-medical interventions that would be just very common that you would recommend? What are the big mistakes people make that affect their sleep, like their routines, their habits, their environments? If without diagnosing someone in particular, what can you say in general that people could look for, and things that they could do that would just be good for them anyway? So, yeah. You know, if I tell people to eat more kale, you know, I don't know anyone who's ever suffered from that. There's no negative side effects. So what are some of the things you'd recommend that have only, you know, neutral or positive side effects that can help with people's sleep problems?
Yeah, of course. So I just want to point out that we're shifting away from sleep-related breathing disorders, okay?
Yeah, we're going to come back to that offline when I can I can reveal all the sordid stories to you.
I have no video camera, I promise. So if I were to break it down into three steps. First thing I'd want to do is put it in context. By that I mean sleep takes place in the context of rhythm. So earlier I mentioned that sleep is defined by EEG frequency, and that during the course of the night we wax and wane in and out of deeper stages of sleep about once every 100 minutes or so. At a more macro level, we have daily rhythms, the circadian rhythms. At a more macro level, we have monthly rhythms, the rhythm of the lunar cycle or of a woman's menstrual cycle. At a more macro level,
do men have monthly cycles too?
Well, there's some. That's a loaded question, I suspect, by the tone of your voice.
No, I'm. I'm just. You know, it's. I'd like to think that I do.
Yeah. So it's a controversial topic. Scientifically, you know, the data is sort of very mixed, but colloquially, lots of people will talk about parallel processes between men and women, in terms of obviously not menstruation, but hormonal shifts and so on and so forth. It makes perfect sense to me. Speaking as a guy, not a scientist.
Right. Yeah, well, a friend of mine always says, you know, I'm a leader of men and a follower of women. So,
yeah, that's exactly.
It probably made evolutionary sense to entrain to a certain extent.
Ah, highly adaptive. This is highly adaptive.
Okay, I'll live with that for now.
At an even more macro level, you know, you have the rhythm, annual rhythm, rhythm of the seasons, as we enter fall and will be followed, by winter, where you and I live in the sort of mid-Atlantic, or you in the Southeast. Winter will be followed by spring and summer and so on and so forth. At an even more macro level, you could think about stages of life, including, death and becoming fertilizer and so on and so forth. So, sleep takes place in the context of rhythm. And, three steps would be, first, begin to, track your sleep. I'd be happy to share, with any of your listeners, the sleep diary that I use, with patients. I'm sure you can find a free sleep diary, online. But begin to look at what your sleep schedule, is like. What time are you going to bed? How long is it taking you to fall asleep? Are you waking up during the night? And if so, for how long? What time do you wake up in the morning? How do you feel in the morning? So on and so forth. Let's start to gather some data. The second thing, is to keep that rhythm in mind. The single most helpful, and you mentioned earlier, some intellectual, property that I've been working on and so on and so forth, has to do with developing adaptive, pre-sleep routines to fall asleep faster and stay asleep longer and to achieve that deep restful sleep that we're all, craving. Develop a pre-sleep, routine, use nature as a guide. Too many of our lives go from, dawn to sunrise to day to day to day to day to day to night, and we need to reinsert some dusk. So take some time. You can begin to darken your household environment, for example. Avoid electronic stimulation. Avoid cognitively or emotionally activating activities within a couple hours of bed. Avoid vigorous exercise within 4 hours of bed. Vigorous exercise increases our core body temperature. And I mentioned earlier that sleep is a cooling down period. If your core body temperature is artificially increased, it's going to be even more difficult to fall asleep and then stay asleep.
That's reminding me of, you know, we spent a year in Africa, and one of the things that would happen at dusk, and we'd always go out and look at it, is like all the baboons would gather on the hill and sit and sort of stare off into space. And they, you know, they were just looking like depressed. Like if, you know, I had to impute human emotions on them, like they're all bummed out. And they would just sort of sit there for a while as it grew dark. And then when it was kind of too dark to see them, that we could hear them like scrambling off back to their nests and bunkers for the night.
So they had a wind down ritual.
Yeah.
I mean, is that what I hear you saying?
I guess that's how I'm interpreting it based on your discussion of dusk.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, their wind down ritual, it sounds like. That would have been fascinating. Maybe sometime you can share photographs. But it sounds like that wind down ritual included some shared social time, perhaps a spiritual time. You know, it was a very clear. It was a time of transition, and we need to be more appreciative of our need from transition from busy day into restful night. And in order to do that, we're going to have to be aware of and choose to ignore or even rebel against all of those societal influences that you mentioned earlier. I tell folks that I've spoken with thousands of people about their sleep, and I've never met one for whom the news is relaxing. So begin to think about the transition from day into night. The third thing, Howard, would be to get more sleep than you're currently getting. As a brushstroke generalization, we're not getting enough sleep. And obviously, and maybe someday we will have a call with top 10 sleep tips or so on and so forth. But those three would be track your sleep, emphasize transition from day to night and consistency in your sleep. And third is allocate more time for sleep quantity.
Well, they sound very commonsensical, and they sound like the sorts of things that most people won't do.
Yes.
Does it help to have the white coat in order, like, you know, and I'm sure I've read like tips like this before, and I'm like, yeah, right.
Right.
What do you recommend for people that who are, you know, to take this seriously, to actually get started, improving the quality of their sleep? And I don't know if this is a segue into the stuff you're working on, the informational products that people can get, but what, you know, how do you recommend people get this advice into their lives?
Focus on the first step. The biggest difference, and it's, I believe I'd confessed, if I hadn't, I've been saving a big confession, that I am undecided on dietary philosophy, my personal dietary philosophy. We'd spoken some in the past about, you have opposing philosophies, both which appear to have a robust evidence base. By that I mean, and there are obviously multiple, but a sort of paleo approach versus a plant-based approach and so on and so forth. And so I've been waiting to spring that confession on you. But the biggest difference would suggest is not whether one chooses a plant-based diet or a paleo diet or any of the myriad spin-offs. It's actually, are you going to pay more attention to diet at all and become more mindful about your food and more purposeful about your dietary choices? We had spoken, not on the call, but you and I had spoken some about my background in the past. I came from a sort of high performance athletics and peak performance background. And I always used to get a kick out of when folks would argue about should you do push-ups or bench press or, you know, lift weights or run. And none of that matters if you aren't first off the couch. So, and the difference between running or lifting weights or push-ups or bench press is much, much smaller than the difference between potato chips and television and doing any of the above, right? So it's the same thing with sleep. And this is called lowering the bar. So if you are listening to the call and if you have some questions, about your own sleep or daytime performance and so on and so forth, what you want to do is identify the absolute smallest step that you can take to move in a new direction. For most folks, that is going to be keeping a sleep diary or a sleep log. It'll take 60 seconds a day, and after a week, you will have engaged in a new sleep behavior for 7 consecutive days. And now we have some behavioral momentum that we can begin to build upon in terms of adding layers of change. In terms, it sounded like you had a question.
No, I mean, I absolutely love that advice. The, you know, do the smallest thing you can possibly do. You know, we're not in any rush to improve when the other option is, you know, hurry up and do nothing.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So, so lower the bar and make that first step. We can talk about enlisting social support and goal setting and managing expectations. And I think that's probably too much for this morning. But lower the bar and take the first step. One of your questions was, well, does it help if you have a white coat? My first few years in private practice, I did wear a white coat. I don't wear a white coat anymore. Undoubtedly, my stimulus value as a healthcare provider helps in terms of patient adherence and so on and so forth. But as I get more interested in the need is so great for sleep and diet and exercise for that matter and healthier lifestyles and more purposeful living choices that at some point I will embark in a shift that at least involves some degree of guiding one to many as opposed to one on one. And so your listeners can keep an eye out for that too. They can send you questions and we'll address them in a follow-up call. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. That'd be great. I'll direct people to post their questions as comments to this podcast post. And, I'm sure we will talk again. I'm highly motivated to find out more. I have 2 pages of scribbled questions that I think are beyond the scope of this first call. I want to end with a question. It might be a little bit weird, but after working on Whole for over a year, I ended up and really diving into the science and the details and the facts, I ended up with an almost reverential view of the human body and nature and biology and cosmos. And I'm wondering, you know, beyond all your work as a scientist, is there some part of you that views sleep as just a mystery, as something to wonder at?
Absolutely. 100%. And I think that any reductionist approach that says we have all the answers is terrifying. And folks who purport such worldviews, are oftentimes terrifying themselves. One has only to look at the importance of sleep and dreaming, for example, throughout human history to realize that there is something deeply mysterious and that warrants reverence. I think that that our job as leaders is to embody and act upon the best knowledge that we have with an eye towards the fact that chances are we know a drop in the bucket.
Beautiful. Well, there's so much more I want to talk to you about. Some of it we'll do offline. Some of which I hope we will do publicly for others' benefit. Dr. Emerson Wickwire, sleep expert and my friend, thank you so much for taking this hour to talk with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
And you.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.